From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. In the news this week, Russia sends 60 American diplomats packing in the latest move in the tit-for-tat over the spy attack in Britain. President Trump fires another cabinet secretary. Attorney General Jeff Sessions rejects calls for a second special counsel to review FBI misconduct. Also this week, Stormy Daniels describes her alleged affair with Donald Trump in a ratings bonanza interview with 60 Minutes correspondent Anderson Cooper.
The president watches 60 Minutes. If he's watching tonight, what would you say to him?
He knows I'm telling the truth.
A surprise meeting between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Chinese President Xi Jinping on Wednesday, announced on North Korean state television.
A historical event that elevates North Korea-Chinese relations to a higher level.
And a massive student-led march in the nation's capital, with hundreds of marches around the country for gun control. In Washington, protesters chanted, "Vote them out." This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Molly Ball, Zach Beecham, and On Point news analyst Jack Peedy. You can join us on air or online. Now that Russia has expelled American diplomats, what happens to the relationship? What do you make of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' refusal to appoint an independent counsel to investigate the FBI? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from New York is Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine. She wrote the magazine's cover story this week about Attorney General Jeff Sessions. You can find a link to the story at our website, onpointradio.org. Molly, good to have you with us.
Hi, Ray. Great to be here.
With us from Washington is Zach Beecham, senior writer at Vox covering global affairs. Zach, welcome to On Point.
Happy to be on.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, his Hanover, New Hampshire listening post, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Ray, Zach, and Wally.
Zach, let's start with you. The back and forth with Russia that started with the attack on Sergei and Yulia Skripal, living in Britain, but now retaliatory expulsions of Russians allowed to live in various Western capitals, and now Russia fighting back, closing the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg. Are we done, or are we just getting started?
I believe we're just getting started. This is a situation in which there's a united front in the policy side of the West, and I emphasize policy side because the political side, that is to say, President Trump, has a sort of different approach to the entire issue. But when it comes to people who are making the lower level decisions about expelling diplomats or things like that, there really is a consensus that this attack in the UK was a breaking point and that Russia has pushed too far in terms of its interference inside NATO allies. And so Russia's retaliation in response to, you know, the broader Western efforts to expel diplomats will likely lead to some other form of Western action. I don't know what it will be, but the sense is that there's a real will to put costs on the Kremlin for, you know, its brazen assassination attempt.
Molly Ball, a lot of the coverage that followed the American expulsion seemed to be written in a tone of almost relief that finally Donald Trump seemed to be showing his eye teeth to the Russians.
I think relief is certainly the mood among Republicans on Capitol Hill, probably Democrats too, for that matter. You know, Trump's rhetoric toward Russia and toward Putin in particular has been consistently friendly, and as president, he hasn't stopped that. But he also hasn't stopped his administration and the specialists in this area from making moves like this, which I think, you know, the diplomatic and policy community is pretty united on, as Zach said, viewing this as a bridge too far. It isn't really just getting started because we've repeatedly taken punitive measures against Russia in this vein before. The Obama administration expelled Russians and closed consulates in response to the election meddling. Previously, there was Ukraine. So again and again, Western governments have taken punitive measures against Putin and Russia. And at this point, there's a possibility of running out of diplomats to expel, running out of punitive measures to take. And that raises the possibility that the next step could be economic measures.
Jack Beattie?
Well, that would be something. You know, one economic measure, Ed Luce, I think, is one of the outstanding interpreters of American politics. He's the columnist for the Financial Times. He had a piece the other day on the sort of deep structure of Russian connections with Britain and the United States. And that is, in our two countries, almost alone among the big democracies, you can have anonymous ownership of real estate and other assets. And that results, according to the Treasury Department, in $300 billion a year in laundered money coming into the U.S. and $150 billion into Britain. And Luce suggests if you really want to get tough with Russia, change this, make this transparent. Of course, that might well cause the Trump empire, which could well be sustained by loans from one way or another from Russia, to fall. But it does get at the deeply compromising connection between Russian oligarch money and the American and British scene.
Zach Beauchamp, given what Jack just talked about, two places that come very much to mind are New York and London, where there are high-end luxury apartments that are vacant 51 weeks a year, owned by oligarchs, Britain, soccer teams and cricket pitches, and a heavy investment into the entertainment economy by oligarchs, recycled Russian oil money. Is the West ready to move on these guys if the provocation gets too serious?
You know, it's funny. I used to live in London, and there's a picturesque square in downtown London. You wouldn't tell it from any of the other pretty parts in central London, only it's known as Red Square, colloquially there, because everything is owned by Russians. And, you know, that kind of property concentration, as you said, is well known. But at the same time, Britain, which is already facing financial difficulties over its impending decision to leave the EU, may not want to cut out a source of external funding. So I don't think that the United States, for its own political reasons, or the UK, is ready to move on Russian ownership of property in their country. However, if this continues to escalate, if these tit-for-tat measures get worse and U.S. And NATO relations with Russia continue to deteriorate, that's a distinct possibility. You're already hearing calls for it in Britain. It's less on the docket here again because, as Jack suggested, you can't imagine President Trump taking action against anonymous Russian ownership of properties. But there, you know, you hear calls for it, and it's not outside the realm of possibility in the foreseeable future.
Speaking of Russia, Molly Ball, it was reported in recent days that Rick Gates, formerly high up the food chain in the Trump campaign world, communicated with a former Russian spy during the election season. And former Trump lawyer John Dowd is said to have floated possible pardons for Manafort and Flynn right after the election season was over.
Yeah, these are two separate developments. The first revealed in a new filing in the Mueller case, and the second being reported by sources of the New York Times, I believe. The Gates development, not only was he in contact with this alleged Russian intelligence connected person, but he knew that this person was connected to Russian intelligence at the time he was having these communications. So this is very significant because it suggests that the usefulness of Gates to Mueller is not just related to what Manafort has already been indicted for and what Gates was indicted for before he entered a guilty plea, which is this money laundering stuff that was related to his lobbying business and occurred long before he came into contact with Trump. This indicates that that Mueller is using the information that Gates has to get at the activities specifically of the campaign. And so the circle continues to tighten around the president, although he still has not been directly implicated that we know of. And the pardons issue is another very interesting one. We have heard Trump muse out loud about this idea, but some legal scholars believe that it could raise obstruction issues if the president and his lawyers are deploying the president's unique pardon powers as a negotiating tool and using that to influence subjects of the investigation. All of this, you know, there's this constant drip of news around these Russia investigations. It comes out in dribs and drabs. It isn't coming from Mueller and his team, except when they file actual paperwork. There aren't any leaks on that end. And so we have this sort of, you know, blind man and the elephant phenomenon where we're all trying to figure out what the shape of this whole thing is. But we obviously aren't going to know until the full results of the investigation come out. And we have no idea when that will happen.
Jack Beatty, is this just more drip, 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 or are these latest revelations really starting to bite?
Well, it sounds like the latter. I mean, if it's true that Gates is – they're not looking at Gates so much to flip on Manafort as perhaps flip on Trump or on people in the Trump apparatus. That is very significant. Also, you know, CBS reported this week that Manafort is holding out for he's playing hanging tough. He's going to go to trial, and he's holding out for a pardon. He expects to get a pardon. That if that isn't obstruction of justice, then we have to adjust our definition of same. But it certainly looks like a odoriferous understanding.
Well, if you hear that that spinning wheel and that metal on metal in the back, that's the New York State Attorney General sharpening his knives for Paul Manafort, if in fact he does get a pardon. We're talking about the week's top stories. You can join the conversation. Will the revolving door in the White House ever stop spinning? Should the president's physician lead the Veterans Affairs Administration? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Did you believe Stormy Daniels? If asked, would you join Trump's legal team? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour are Molly Ball of Time Magazine, Zach Beecham of Vox, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Former Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin, fired Wednesday by President Trump, told NPR's Morning Edition yesterday he was undone by internal political rebellion.
I was not against reforming VA, but I was against privatization. And I think that it was really the political appointees that were trying to undermine our efforts at VA.
Molly Ball, a lot of attention has gone to Shulkin and his struggles over privatization. That takes the place of the speculation about his spending on private trips, but also a lot of attention on Dr. Ronnie Jackson, the president's personal physician, who is his pick to lead Veterans Affairs.
Ronnie Jackson actually is the White House physician, which is an important distinction because he is, you know, a decorated military officer and not the somewhat wacky dude who previously got some attention for his association with Trump as personal physician. But he is not someone who is, you know, a career Veterans Affairs official, not someone who's had any experience running a large bureaucracy like this, and a surprise pick. As you mentioned, you know, Shulkin was rumored to be on thin ice for a combination of reasons. On the one hand, he had this scandal where he had brought his wife on a trip to Europe using taxpayer money and then apparently instructed his aides to hide the evidence. And there was an inspector general recommendation that he be disciplined for that. On the other hand, Shulkin claims that this was actually about a policy dispute, that he was in favor of keeping the VA in its current mostly public form, but was being undermined by people with a political agenda who'd been appointed at lower levels of the agency who were in favor of this aggressive privatization scheme. So I don't think we quite know which of those was more operative, at least in Trump's mind, in – firing him again in a tweet, as has become the president's MO for sudden cabinet firings. But the Jackson nomination will be very interesting. It will be interesting to see if Republicans in Congress will go along with this, considering the size and scope of the bureaucracy, a troubled bureaucracy that needs a steady hand, and a lot of questions about whether Dr. Jackson, for all of his high marks as in his current position, is equipped to do this job.
The debate over privatization at VA has gone on for years. It goes back to at least George W. Bush and the large number of returning veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq with very serious medical problems that overwhelmed the standing Veterans Administration as it was constituted in the early years of the Bush administration. There's been back and forth. A lot of veterans don't live within easy reach of an existing veterans facility, so privatization was justified in that regard. But a lot of people, including veterans groups, have pushed back and said, no, privatization is not appropriate in this because the existing administration simply needs to be improved. Don't throw us into the private market. Tampa, Florida joins us now. Paul is calling. Paul, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Okay, how are you, Paul?
I'm doing all right. I just wanted to say a couple words about the appointee, Mr. Jackson. To me, there's no wonder that the president is appointing a person like this. You know, the fact itself that at this point we have a president that apparently is not qualified to run the country says enough. So, you know, the person that he's appointing is, to me, just a yes man, somebody that will make the president feel better. But he's not really qualified to run such a big department that employs hundreds of thousands of people.
Paul, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, I guess it'll be an interesting acid test of just how much Congress is willing to test presidential nominees to watch the Jackson confirmation process.
Yes. You know, his one moment of publicity that I can recall was when he saved the president from the ignominy of being obese. Apparently the president came within a pound of that official designation. But as Paul Krugman points out, the president apparently gained an inch in height while in the White House, and that saved him from that. Looking at this sort of the privatization business, I think the Times is on to something when they say, so we come back to the Koch brothers. Mark Hanner said there are two things that are important in politics. The first is money, and I can't remember what the second is. The Koch brothers want this. The Koch brothers pay the bills of large parts of the Republican Party. The Koch brothers have been on a campaign to roll back not just the Great Society, but the New Deal. And this is and privatization of health care for the VA is part of their ideological crusade. And no doubt there are profits to be made in it, too, for them or their satraps.
Ooh, satraps. There will be a little quiz at the end of today's Weekly News Roundtable, but that's a very rarely used word on this program, both by the listeners and by the hosts. Jack Beatty in Hanover, New Hampshire. Zach,
we have
Beecham
a lot of satraps up here.
Don't step into any of them. Also this week, Jeff Sessions, Molly Ball. I want to quickly touch on this because the guy who is week in, week out, rumored to be on the chopping block, intensifying the sessionization of the Justice Department with his view toward treatment and punishment in the area of drug crime, and at the same time pushing back on Republican efforts to get a second special counsel investigation going. What's latest on the Sessions front?
I spent some time with Jeff Sessions for this article that's on the cover of Time magazine this week, and I was interested in this incredible irony of the position that he's in right now. I would argue that he is the most effective member of the cabinet when it comes to implementing Trump's vision that he campaigned on, turning the rhetoric into reality, the sort of unique and much remarked upon populist nationalist ideas that Trump talked about on the campaign trail. Sessions is more in sync with that than probably anybody in current politics, and he has moved swiftly and effectively to undo the Obama policies of the Justice Department, which in many cases were aimed at making the criminal justice system more lenient and more equitable, and turned it right around and with the emphasis on law and order that Sessions and Trump are both so inspired by. But despite all that he seems to be doing for Trump, as everybody is aware, his boss doesn't exactly seem to appreciate Jeff Sessions because of the Russia recusal primarily. And then the new development of Sessions declining to appoint another special counsel to investigate the FBI may inflame Trump further. We will see about that. Trump has been, you know, publicly and privately razzing Sessions for the decisions that he disagrees with, and it would cause a major conflagration in Washington if Sessions were to be fired. His view, as he told me in our interview, he's quite sympathetic to Trump and his position. Remember, nobody supported Donald Trump earlier or more ardently than Jeff Sessions. But he feels that he's following the rules, and that's about law and order, too. He's someone who's always believed in following the rules, whether it comes to crime and punishment or illegal immigration. And so this is the position that he's in, and we'll see how long he lasts. I don't think he knows. I asked him, are you going to be fired? He said, well, one man knows the answer to that.
From our website, Omaha Guy writes, if Donald Trump can make a stock temporarily change by criticizing it, then the Mercer family are the ones who can take advantage of it, regardless of which way it moves. Michigan JK writes, Putin's interference in worldwide elections has proven to be a cheap, easy way to instigate ruinous policies in countries all over the globe. He uses populist, divisive rhetoric, which has proven effective to manipulate the masses throughout history. This is not genius, original, or novel. Zach Beauchamp. The cabinet turmoil and now Washington taking the measure of the tandem of Bolton and Pompeo in very important jobs. This must be an interesting time to be writing about foreign affairs in Washington.
Oh, it's fascinating and a touch frightening, I would say. Both Mike Pompeo, but especially John Bolton, are defined by their hawkishness. And Bolton is... Even in hawkish Washington, where military force is often seen as a solution to problems it might not be able to solve, John Bolton is on the extreme hawkish wing. He has advocated for the use of force against Iran and North Korea, and perhaps simultaneously. And now, as national security advisor, he has a fairly powerful bureaucracy that he can help direct. And he also – his principal job will be controlling the flow of information to the president, telling President Trump – what's important to understand and giving his policy recommendations while synthesizing everything really that the other cabinet secretaries are putting together, right? Everything from the State Department, Defense Department, you name it. The result is that Bolton, who is very ideological and very hawkish, will be able to shape the way that the president sees the world. Now, how effectively anyone can manage Donald Trump is certainly open to question. But putting somebody like that in that position suggests we could see a radical revamp of the early Trump administration policies, which had been surprisingly conciliatory. And, you know, finally agreeing to talk with North Korea after all the saber rattling, not tearing up the Iran deal as Trump suggested that he would. Now, all of a sudden, depending on what Bolton and Pompeo do in their jobs, and if Pompeo is confirmed by the Senate, which is not necessarily guaranteed, we could see a real reversal.
Zach, I don't want to miss the opportunity to discuss briefly how Bolton and Pompeo spell each other when it comes to providing intellectual space and legitimacy in the conversation for really tough, tough talk about Islam, the Islamic world, and even Muslims in the United States.
It's important to understand that tough talk is quite euphemistic. It's very polite of you, right, to not talk about these people, the groups that Bolton and Pompeo have been affiliated with. These include people like Frank Gaffney, who is a former Reagan administration official who has suggested that major Islamic organizations in the United States are secret fronts for Islamist groups designed to undermine the United States from within. People like Pamela Geller, who said to me in my presence that migration of refugees from Syria is a secret ISIS plot to undermine Europe in general. One of Gaffney's groups suggested that we might need to close 80% of mosques in the United States in a paper that his organization put out. These people aren't just friends or close with Bolton and Pompeo, but they actively have organizational affiliations. Bolton and Pompeo both regularly went on Gaffney's radio show, which he hosted. This is a whole subtle, quiet movement I've written about at length called the Counter Jihad, which has a surprisingly large amount of influence on the foreign policy right, but really promotes this extreme view of Islam as essentially, more than clash of civilizations, Islam is a political doctrine rather than a religion that threatens the foundations of American democracy. And so these people will now have two voices at the top levels of the U.S. government who don't quite outright espouse their views, but at least are sympathetic to them and have worked to promote them in and bring them into the mainstream. Bolton at one point literally made sure that Gaffney could attend a major conservative conference, working behind the scenes to undo a ban that was imposed because Gaffney was seen as too toxic, even for the, you know, relatively hawkish on Islam right. So this is a very serious, and if you talk to Muslims in the United States, a very frightening development.
The very first question Anderson Cooper asked Stormy Daniels during Sunday's 60 Minutes interview was about the risk involved or whether or not she could be fined $1 million for talking to him.
I guess I'm not 100% sure on why you're doing this.
Because it was very important to me to be able to defend myself.
Is part of talking wanting to set the record straight?
100%.
Why does the record need to be set straight?
Because people are just saying whatever they wanted to say about me. I was perfectly fine saying nothing at all. But I'm not okay with being made out to be a liar or people thinking that I did this for money. And people are like, oh, you're an opportunist. You're taking advantage of this.
Jack Beatty, I don't want to go on this about this too long, but is this a problem that's going to stick to Trump's shoe as we move through this still young year? Or does at some point Stormy Daniels, sort of like a storm itself, blow itself out?
Well, the answer is I don't know, but I think it's going to stick to the shoe of his reputation. You know, we've had to consistently define the presidency down to Trump. And here we see again the kind of man he is, his lubricious character, if you will. And second, she made a very startling revelation there in that interview that she was threatened in a Las Vegas parking lot when the only people, you know, to keep mum about this, when the only people who knew about it were Trump connected. And, you know, that isn't a that's not some eccentric piece of information that doesn't fit a pattern. Reporters have voluminously gone through the record of, death threats against New York, board of whatever real estate who upping his taxes, a 12-year-old boy and his mother effectively kidnapped or held hostage for a bit, and the boy pushed around by Trump associates in some bizarre connection, and on and on and on. Trump has not been averse in his private dealings from thugism.
When C.C. Wong met his mom's new tenant, he never suspected he'd end up getting replaced as a son, or that his replacement might have sinister motives. This week, Invisibilia looks at the things we don't say to our loved ones and the misunderstandings it can lead to. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. It's the weekly news roundtable. With the widow of the Pulse nightclub gunman who killed 49 people in the 2016 attack in Central Florida has been acquitted of all charges. She was charged with knowing about the planning of the crime beforehand, charged with aiding and abetting. In other news this week, Linda Brown, the girl at the center of the Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas case, died this week at 75. Here's Brown speaking at the University of Michigan in 2004.
To me, the impact of Brown is best seen in the increasing numbers of black professionals today. These are the people that after 1954 were able to have some degree of choice. This surely made a difference in their aspirations and their achievements.
Malala Yousafzai, the youngest Nobel laureate, arrived in Pakistan yesterday, her first visit there since Taliban militants shot her in the head 5 years ago. She addressed education activists.
It's not just giving books and building a school. I think it's thinking critically and thinking of sustainable ways in where you should invest and how you should invest. And these things are really, really important.
And yesterday was Major League Baseball's opening day. It's the first time since 1968 every team opened on the same day. Ian Happ with the Chicago Cubs homered on the very first pitch of 2018.
And a drive to right.
Go, baby.
Gone. Oh, baby.
Oh, my. That's unbelievable.
The season has begun.
And President Trump traveled to Ohio yesterday. There he said he may delay a trade deal with South Korea, one he'd only just announced while working on the North Korea situation.
I may hold it up till after a deal is made with North Korea. Does everybody understand that? Do you know why, right? Do you know why? Because it's a very strong card. And I want to make sure everyone is treated fairly, and we're moving along very nicely with North Korea. We'll see what happens.
And we'll stop next in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Joseph, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my call. I just wanted to get your guest thoughts. The last three presidents have talked about talking to North Korea, but it wasn't until Trump called him out, Little Rocket Man, Fury like you've never seen before, that we actually see the leader of North Korea headed to a discussion with, well, anybody. Previously, it's always been smoke and mirrors from North Korea, and now we're seeing what may actually be, no guarantee, of course, the possibility of actual results in dealing with North Korea. And I'm curious, do they think this is coincidence? Because I think it's a direct result of what the president has been doing and his stance toward North Korea and the regime and it hasn't been bullying. It's simply been standing up to the bully. And no one has ever done that before. I mean, Carter bribed him with $4 billion, but I don't know that really counts as getting anywhere. So, I mean, I think we're seeing results for the first time, and I think Trump is the reason.
Molly Ball, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. On a sort of a tentative basis, we'll see where it all goes, right? And the direct talks that Trump proposed, surprising even his staff and the State Department when he did so, there's a lot of work to be done arranging them, and a date and a place have not been set. But we have seen some really unprecedented moves by Kim Jong-un, as the caller said, even apparently committing to some form of denuclearization, which is a huge step. So we will see where it goes. We'll see if it actually happens. You know, at the Gridiron Dinner, which is this gathering of Washington journalists to sort of make fun of themselves and each other and the politicians, Trump made a joke. He said, people ask, when it comes to North Korea, people say, you know, you can't negotiate with a madman. Well, that's his problem, not mine, which I thought was a good line. And there may be some truth to it in the sense that, you know, the degree to which Trump is able to sort of give Kim a taste of his own medicine with the bluster and the threats and the my button is bigger than yours, he may in fact be speaking his language to a degree that has been effective.
At the same time, Zach Beecham, that this word is coming out of Washington, Xi Jinping met with Kim Jong-un in China this week.
Right. So I think that it's important to see this, the current negotiations, not as a break from the past, as your caller suggested, but kind of a continuation, just in a new direction. It's actually quite common for North Korean leaders to meet with Chinese leaders. This is Kim's first one. It's probably in preparation for the talks with the U.S. But, you know, it's something that they do or used to, his father and his grandfather did with some regularity. And when it comes to the overall arc of North Korea politics, it's important to bear in mind that both prior North Korean dictators had offered to negotiate directly with the United States. North Korea has long wanted these negotiations in and of themselves as a way of legitimizing them as an international power and saying, look, we have nuclear weapons. We're able to talk as equals with the United States, our great rival. They've also long said they've been open to denuclearization. The conditions, however, were that the United States would withdraw its security assistance, troop placement, and agreement to defend South Korea, which is a no-go for Washington. And Kim has not taken back those previous commitments. So what Trump has done is do something that no U.S. leader has been able to do in the past or interested in doing in the past, really, is agreeing to sit down with North Korea and talk on their terms rather than multilateral negotiations between multiple different parties. So in essence, despite Trump's talk of being a canny negotiator, instead of by not doing low-level talks first and then going straight to a top-level summit, the president has, well, given away some of his leverage before things even started. And North Korea, as you can see from this trip to China, is taking full advantage, getting ready while the U.S. is – well, it's not clear what the U.S. is doing.
Iowa City, Iowa is next. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ray. Yes. Bear with me here. My thinking about this whole situation is that both Trump and Kim Jong-un are trying to back away from a situation that's become impossible. Here's what I mean by that. The North Koreans are not going to denuclearize without the United States pulling out troops from South Korea. The United States aren't going to pull troops out of South Korea. So now Trump's got us in a situation where denuclearization means nothing whatsoever. So there's really no place to go with this except for an escalation unless everybody steps back toward the status quo. Because now if Trump pursues this denuclearization idea, what we have is a situation that he can't really meet, and therefore he's heightened expectations. He has John Bolton in there with him now. And I think that's a very scary situation.
Jack, what do you think?
Well, I completely agree with the presence of Bolton there, who has talked about a preventive war, or a preemptive strike, if you will, on North Korea, which would be the fuse of a vast human disaster. This picture of North Korea as being bluffed by Trump's rhetoric and so on, the South Korean president has given credence to that. He's mentioned the Trump's hard line and especially China's joining in sanctions against North Korea, that these things have really helped. But Korean experts also say it's also helped that and this may be picking up on what the caller says, it's also helped that the North Koreans are now speaking from a position of strength. Their missile testing, the range of their missiles, all that sort of thing, has sort of put them in a even Steven position with the United States. Hardly, of course, but at least in their professional, among their military, they can feel, we can reach you, you can reach us, let's talk as equals. And that sort of building up of his deterrence against us is also a factor in his willingness to talk.
Protests continued in Sacramento following the death of Stephon Clark, an unarmed black man who was fatally shot by police last week. The grief was palpable as his brother, Stevante Clark, spoke at Stephon's funeral yesterday.
We're going to do coliseums for Stefan. We're going to do libraries. We're going to do resources centers. We're going to allow Stefan is going to live for generations to generations to generations to generations.
There is eerie police surveillance tape taken from an aerial shot of a helicopter with heat-sensing cameras that show Stefan Clark's progress through backyards and over fences, and then police sneaking up on him from another direction and taking him down in a fusillade of gunfire. During this same week that prosecutors in Baton Rouge announced that they will not prosecute police there for the shooting of Alton Sterling, who was selling CDs outside a convenience store. This happens in the wake of the anti-gun violence marches all around the country. It seems that this is front of mind and almost moving Molly Ball on an independent track. This issue remains with us stubbornly.
Yes, it absolutely does. And the regularity of these sorts of incidents, I think, is what keeps it on the radar. You know, it's been very striking and quite noticeable to the people involved in this issue that the president has no problem commenting on things like players kneeling at NFL games. But when it comes to these sorts of incidents, which is what those protests are about, he's completely silent. And in fact, when asked about it at the White House press briefing this week, the line was that this is a purely local matter. So I think to the people involved in this issue, and you know, this is part of the Justice Department approach that I talked about as well. They see a White House that is not interested in helping them advance justice as they see it. And you know, the Obama administration did a lot of work to the Obama Justice Department to increase federal oversight of local police departments because of issues like this, famously in Ferguson, but also in other places, investigating systematic police practices and discrimination, entering into consent decrees with some of these departments. Under Jeff Sessions, the Justice Department has withdrawn from those decrees and has turned away from that approach.
Referring to it even as undermining or handcuffing police. I mean, it not just stopped the inquests, but also spoken out against them as a way of thwarting police efforts to control crime in neighborhoods.
That's right. So, Sessions, I spoke to him about this, subscribes to the theory that when you, quote, let the ACLU run the police department, all you do is you demoralize officers and even increase crime. He is a believer in the controversial theory that when police feel that they can't do their jobs because of political oversight, they stop keeping the streets safe and crime increases. So this is a very controversial theory, and certainly, as I said, a 180-degree reversal from the previous administration's view.
Oklahoma City, Oklahoma is next. Stephen, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Ray. My children really don't want to participate in the March for Our Lives. They're being bullied, harassed. They've lost friends. They don't want to participate. This positive peer pressure is felt also with my nieces in Atlanta and Chicago. And it's very anti-civil, and it's anti-civil rights because it's breaching their right to free speech, and not to participate is part of free speech, and they're being bullied across the nation. And this is something that also is attacking the Second Amendment, which basically helps us on the First Amendment. And I ask you, Ray, do you have an AR-15?
No, I don't.
And why is that?
Just not interested. I mean, I don't own a driver or a putter either. I mean, just not an interest.
But we don't want to violate people who do. We don't want to take the property of those who do have a driver and a putter and enjoy golf. So this is kind of the same thing. It's a property right issue. It's a civil rights issue. And I think Linda Brown is probably turning in her grave as she could see the harassment in our public schools. For example, our teachers are walking out on Monday. They're abandoning our kids, but yet they think they're doing it for our kids. So there's a lot of social, what I'd even call Marxist positions that have been in the school system really since I've been involved in public schools since 1964.
Well, Stephen, thanks a lot for your call. I don't want to cut you off, but I do want to hear from the panelists on your comments. Jack Beatty.
Well, I didn't know about any of this, and so I'll try to read up on it. I can imagine that harsh things could have been said to young people who don't want to participate. That's the way these things tend to work. But the idea of Marxist influence in the schools does seem to me a bit of a stretch. It has a John Birch feeling. That was one of their canards, sort of. But you know, just to get to this amazing weekend of these young people and their friends all over the country, indeed the world, this was a historic moment. What its effects will be, we don't know. But it's wrong to say, or it's limited to say, that they're just fighting for, you know, better regulations of guns. No, they're fighting for majority rule, the basic principle of democracy, which is violated every day that the National Rifle Association sits atop the Republican Party and prevents what supermajorities want on gun control. They're fighting for democracy.
We've only got about 20 seconds left. Zach Beauchamp, do those marches put guns on the agenda for the midterms in a way they weren't before?
They do. The issue with gun policy had always been that a small number of gun owners were dictating issues. But now, with all this activism surrounding the majority position in the United States, as Jack said, which is that you should have better regulation of guns, there's a real chance that people might be forced to change their minds in Congress.
Zach Beauchamp's a senior reporter at Vox. Great to have you with us. Molly Ball is national political correspondent for Time magazine. Great to talk to you, Molly.
Thank you, Ray.
And as always, we're joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you, Ray.
Continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up Monday, what does the world look like when you're sitting in Beijing? From tariffs to North Korea and Trump, what China wants. Have a happy Easter. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.